Welcome to session number 5 in the Biblical Doctrines of Civil Government. In this session, I'd like to discuss what the Bible has to say about forms of government. God expects the nations to rule according to his moral law, but that rule may be administered by a monarchy or an oligarchy or a republic or a democracy. But before we discuss those forms of government, there is one form of government we know that God prohibits universally, and that is an empire. And one of the first biblical texts in regard to the doctrine of civil government deals with this subject. Genesis chapter 11, the Tower of Babel. Verse 1. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. They said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make a name for ourselves, otherwise we will be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. The Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so they will not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. What's going on here, and why did God stop this project? The Children's Sunday School version is that these ancient people wanted to build a tower to reach into God's dwelling place, heaven. But no, they wanted to build a city that would serve as a capital for a one-world government, because the elites didn't want the people to be scattered. Because if they were scattered, they couldn't be controlled, and they couldn't be taxed. The tower was to be a rallying point to build name recognition, a way to give the impression of authority. You know, we know that this is even done in our day. People build edifices, they build theme parks, they build one of the 8 wonders of the world, and people will pay to come and see it, and businesses will grow up around it. But God was not pleased with this agenda, because in chapter 11, verse 6, nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. In other words, they will be able to monopolize power. And who can stand against the power of a one-world government? There will be no competition to serve as a check. And if the righteous were persecuted in that city, there would be no other city to which they could flee. With the city of Babylon in control of everything, nobody could vote with their feet. Remember the Soviet Iron Curtain? It wasn't created to keep people out, but to keep people in. Since mankind is by default sinful, the unified power of man will always result in injustice and oppression. And the righteous are always in the minority, so minority rights need to be protected. As an American thought, there is a need for division of power. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's certainly not a belief of Marxism. So God broke up their plans by reinforcing his prohibition against an empire with a little extra incentive. He divided up the languages according to family lines so that the people would not get along so well. And this is the basis for the Christian belief in nationalism. As we also see in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8, God separated the sons of men. He set boundaries for the people. And in Acts chapter 17, the Apostle Paul tells the Athenians, God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all of the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. You know, it's man in his greed and power that has resulted in empires throughout history. The Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Persian, the Greeks, the Romans, where evil, unprincipled men steal lands given to other people groups, claiming that unity will be better for everyone. But God has always shortened the life of these empires. You know, in the Revelation, at the end of this age, the prophecy is that the world will once again try to establish a one-world government, spiritually called Babylon. And this follows along with mankind's rebellion against God in the last days. Also be aware that world leaders today and the intelligentsia are increasingly believing that a one-world government will be the solution to all of mankind's problems. And so they're pushing for globalism and a borderless world. Since these people aren't looking to God for deliverance, all they have to look to is man and the combined power of man in government. And that's why their status. But as we see in the Revelation, in this, they will walk right into a trap. The very thing they believe will solve their problems will be their undoing. So God's plan for government is separate nations, and this is a Christian teaching which is despised and criticized by atheistic systems. But as far as the nations themselves, which form of government is proper? A monarchy, an oligarchy, republic, democracy? One point in this lesson that's going to surprise many people is that the Bible makes allowances for each form of government given the situation. There is not one universal form of government that must be enforced in all nations. And here I want to again quote John Calvin's treatise on civil government, 1560, because his work has had a great influence on the Puritan mind in early America. And Calvin wrote the most complete work on this subject. It best represents the position of the Protestant reformers. By the way, Martin Luther also wrote some pamphlets on the doctrines of civil government. First, in 1520, a pamphlet entitled To the Christian Nobility of the German Nation, Respecting the Reformation of the Christian Estate, and then another pamphlet in 1522 entitled On Worldly Authority. And most theologians today recognize that Luther was not complete in his writings on civil government, as Calvin. Luther was less organized, less clear. He dealt with his own localized situation, whereas Calvin was a more careful theologian, writing a timeless theological textbook on the overall biblical teachings concerning civil government. So anyway, in Calvin's treatise on civil government, section 8, Calvin writes that men often discuss which form of government polity is best. But the answer depends on circumstances. A monarchy is prone to tyranny. An aristocracy, the rule by an elite class, is prone to faction. And popular ascendancy, a democracy, has a strong tendency toward sedition. But then Calvin goes on to explain that he believes the best form of government is an aristocracy, a rule by a group of educated leaders, whether that be a pure aristocracy or one modified by popular government, the vote of the people. And what Calvin was referring to is what we would call a republic, where the people elect wise representatives to rule. And the reason Calvin gives for a republic being the best form of government is because, quote, it is so rare for a king to rule justly and wisely. So because of the defects of men, it is safer and more tolerable for several to bear rule, that they may thus mutually assist, instruct, and admonish each other, and should any one be disposed to go too far, the others are censors and masters to curb his excess. Does this sound familiar? It's a concept of checks and balances put forth by our founding fathers. Alexander Hamilton in the Federalist Papers number 10 sounds very much like Calvin in arguing for a representative republic. But then Calvin goes on to give another reason why a republic, an aristocracy, is the best form. Because it's what God himself originally set up over Israel. Before Israel demanded a king in around 1000 BC, for the 400 years prior, God had Israel ruled by elders from each of the 12 tribes. Government was small and decentralized. And it's clear from 1 Samuel chapter 8 that when the elders of Israel demanded a monarchy, God deemed that a negative, a sin against God. Israel was supposed to be unique. Every other nation had a king, but Israel was to be ruled by God, Yahweh Elohim, a rule by God's law, not a rule by a human king. Because the pagan nations didn't have the moral rule of God, they resorted to an authoritarian rule to keep order. When the Constitutional Convention ended in 1787, a woman asked Benjamin Franklin, "Dr. Franklin, what have we got, a monarchy or a republic?" Franklin replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." Suggested in that reply is that a republic cannot be kept by every people. Remember also John Adams said about our Constitution and our form of government, quote, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate to the government of any other." A question implied in that statement is what kind of government would be for an immoral, non-religious people? Proverbs chapter 28, verse 2. "By the transgression of the land, many are its princes." In other words, an unprincipled, immoral people need additional layers of government. More government control. Freedom is only for those who can handle freedom. So therefore, it would not be the best state of affairs for every people group to be under what we would call the best, the original form of government given to Israel. But this often confuses people. Because if in 1 Samuel chapter 8, the people sinned in wanting a monarchy, how could a monarchy ever be the right form of government for any people group? And this is where theologians like to distinguish between the will of God versus the perfect will of God. Romans chapter 12, verse 2. The will of God for a criminal would be for the criminal to go to jail, given his sinful condition. But the perfect will of God would be for that man never to have been a criminal in the first place. But given his condition, God makes concessions and allowances. He gets, in a sense, a different will of God. For example, the Israelites coming out of Egypt. Was it God's will that they would immediately go into the promised land? Or was it God's will that they would wander for 40 years in the wilderness? Well, the wilderness wanderings became the will of God for them, given their faithless spiritual condition. Everyone is in the will of God, but you're either in the perfect will of God for your full blessing, or in the will of God for your discipline or judgment. And this applies to forms of government. For a dysfunctional, unprincipled people, a godless people, God allows for a monarchy. So let's look at 1 Samuel chapter 8, where Israel makes this devastating transition from being an elder-ruled republic to a monarchy, a totalitarian state. There are many important lessons in this chapter that the Christian community needs to come to learn. In chapter 8, verse 2, in order for the current elder-led republican form of polity to work, the prophet Samuel is providing the necessary spiritual leadership. But in chapter 8, verse 3, the elders saw that Samuel's sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. So we see that the moral decline in the leadership would bring about a change of government. not only to curb the corruption, but to punish the people. And providentially, a corrupt people will be attracted to a totalitarian state. So the elders of the various tribes asked Samuel to set up a king for the nation. Now, much could be said here about why these elders wanted a king, given the fact that they would lose power. Maybe they assumed they could control a king, or a king might help moderate disagreements between the elders. But what usually happens in such cases is that civic leaders, in their moral ineptitude, in seeking wrong solutions, are blinded to the unintended consequences. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 20, the elders themselves give two reasons for wanting a king. First, that we might be like other nations. And here we see they're turning to the pagan world for guidance rather than the word of God. The elders didn't appreciate the unique mission Israel had to represent God to the world rather than being like the world. The second reason given is quite alarming, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Do you see the irony here? And I believe the wording is meant to convey the foolishness of their request. Because kings do not fight your battles. They have you fight their battles while they sit on the throne. Here's the timeless principle. Irresponsible, unprincipled people want extra layers of government to fight their education battles, their healthcare battles, their retirement battles, their employment battles, their housing battles, from the cradle to the grave. Godless people will be lazy and they will shirk responsibility. Somebody else needs to take care of them. Somebody else needs to educate and feed my children. And the deception is to believe that the government is there to do for you what God has called you to do for yourself. The same reason the elders gave in 1 Samuel chapter 8 for bigger government is the same reason people use in every generation. But wise and godly civic leaders at some point need to have the courage to tell the people, no, we are not to be doing this for you. Now, even before the people's final demand for a king, Samuel warns the people that a king, a totalitarian state, will be a negative. Samuel said, "This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest, and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will also take of your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and of your vineyards and of your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give them to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of all your flocks, for you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of the king, your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us." So what is the problem with having a king? If you talk with a socialist today, they would see the list of negatives as positives. After all, the king is creating jobs. The king is organizing labor. The people can get all of their security and their equity by working together under the authority of government. But what is the implied downside in Samuel's rebuke? The fruit of your labor is mostly going to the king and his administration. And in political economic theory, big government is inefficient and it's costly because it always results in a leisure ruling class, people making their living off of control. But this comes about as a punishment on an immoral, irresponsible people. As John Adams said, our Constitution was only made for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Now, you would think at this point that Samuel would say, no, you can't have a king. It's a violation of God's will for the nation. But instead, God says to Samuel in chapter 8, verse 7, the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day I brought them up from the land of Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. So this request for a change in the form of government was a spiritual problem, not simply a political one. And they would get a king, and they would need a king given their spiritual aptitude. As the story goes on, Saul is anointed king, and Saul leads Israel to win in the battle against the Ammonites. And as we usually see, a change to a bigger government appears to meet an immediate need in the short term. But in chapter 12, God reminds the people that their wickedness was great in asking for a king. And so as a sign, God destroys their wheat harvest with a devastating storm. The people then acknowledge they have sinned in asking for a king, but it's too late to turn back. And Samuel's reply to them is a guidance and a pattern for all Christian ministry toward unbiblical forms of government. 1 Samuel 12, verse 20. Samuel said to the people, do not fear. You have committed all of this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. You must not turn aside, for then you will go after futile things, which cannot profit or deliver, because they're futile. For the Lord will not abandon his people on account of his great name, because the Lord has been pleased to make you a people for himself. So Samuel gives the people a promise that if they obey and serve God, even in this bad system, it will go well for them. And earlier, Samuel told the people that if they're righteous and they serve God, so also will be their king. The king, the government, will reflect the spiritual character of the people. It's not like so many assume that it's those evil politicians in Washington versus the good citizenship. If there are bad politicians in Washington, it's because the citizenship is also corrupt. That's why they get elected. Now, as Christians, we may see this and just want to throw up our hands and go live off the grid in the wilderness. But there is a pattern for us in that Samuel tells the people that even though they have made this sinful choice, he will still pray for them and instruct them in the good and the right way. Chapter 12, verse 23. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, but I will instruct you in the good and the right way. Two concluding principles to bear in mind. First, recognize that the form or the polity of government is not the primary driving force behind a successful nation. Secularists like to credit America's greatness to a form of government when the credit really belongs to America having a Christian consensus, starting off with a people who held to a Christian worldview. The form of government is the caboose. The gospel is the engine. And our State Department has tried to export democracy around the world, thinking that that's the solution, when the solution is missions, a people group turning to God. A republic, a democracy, is not a cure-all. In fact, without God, a democracy can be a worse tyranny. And there's some scriptural indication that when the Antichrist comes on the scene, he will likely rule by democracy, a vote of majority. So don't put your trust or hope in a change in the forms or the systems of government. Our hope needs to be in the power of the gospel. A second principle. If a country becomes ungodly, do we allow for a totalitarian state? I mean, after all, spiritually, the people may need it for discipline, for judgment. But no, we don't promote it. So scriptures tell us, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. On our part, we always instruct people in the best way. But at a certain point, if the system changes outside of our control by people not listening to God, as in Samuel's case, we accept the change of government as now the necessary will of God for the nation, but we still teach and preach and pray as always. As John Calvin wrote, there is a duty to preserve the form of government that best promotes liberty. Quote, "Nay, even magistrates ought to do their utmost to preserve the liberty of which they have been appointed guardians from being impaired, far less violated. If in this they are sluggish or a little careful in protecting liberty, they are traitors to their office and their country." May Jesus Christ reign.